And good afternoon. Welcome to this month's webinar for our Venture Law Meetup Series. This month we'll be talking about managing up to your board of directors and how to optimize that relationship to get the most out of your board of directors. I'm Leah Brownlee. I'm of counsel at Squire Patton Boggs in the corporate department. And with me today I have my partner, Joe Weinstein, who's also at Squire Patton Boggs, and Sam Drace, the CEO of Conde Inc. And I'll let each of them say a few words to introduce themselves.
Good afternoon. I'm Sam Drace. I've had the good fortune to start, grow, and sell or take public four software companies over the last 35 years. And so I've had direct board experience as a founder and CEO. And then I sit on the board of several for-profit and non-profit companies. So that's it's through those sets of experiences that I have formed my perspective on managing boards.
I suppose I have had, and this is Joe Weinstein, I suppose I've had less fortunate experiences over the last 36 years as I have been an active litigation partner here at the firm and have represented boards of directors in all sorts of disputes. I head up our securities and shareholder litigation practice at the firm, and at a prior stage of my career, I was actually in-house serving as the chief legal officer of a Fortune 500 company and counseling the boards of directors at it and its subsidiaries. So I've got a little different perspective as to how to manage boards of directors in good times and especially bad.
Yeah, thank you, Joe and Sam, for joining us today. You know, a couple of notes about my background in this area. I'm a bit of the flip side from Joe in that I work on the corporate side of things, and I try not to have to call a litigator, though he is a very nice person to call when I need to. But I work actively as the outside general counsel for a number of clients, and that involves almost always sitting in on the board meetings, mentoring clients, in preparation for the board meeting, and you know, going through the whole cycle with these early stage companies on how to optimize their board. And I also spent a number of years in-house, and in that role, I was in the board meetings for 6 years for a publicly traded company, really trying to optimize and manage the board structure in that role. Just a quick note, you know, thank you to all of our co-sponsors. We have 12 different co-sponsors in Cleveland that help promote this event, both the live event and the webinar. So, you know, a big thanks to them for their assistance. And, you know, diving into the topic for today. So managing your board of directors, really the goal is to optimize your board of directors because they are a very expensive set of advisors that are supposed to help launch your company. So I guess starting from the beginning, the question I have, and I'll ask Sam and Joe just to give a few comments, why do we need a board of directors?
Well, I guess I'll start. You know, in the first instance, if you are a C corporation, you need to have a board of directors. You have to have at least one director. But more importantly, as I think Sam will elaborate, you really need to have a diversity of input as you're running a company. And the board of directors is the place to start with that. You can find very skilled people with a variety of different skill sets that bring to bear a variety of different contacts that they bring to bear a variety of different perspectives. And that's all key to a CEO who wants to take the company to the next level.
Yeah, that's right. Joe, and it's been an incredible benefit to me for any CEO who believes that they don't know everything, and that groups, well-managed groups make better decisions. A board is a key asset to a company. It can propel you along faster than your competitors, and you can have the benefit of deep domain expertise at the table, of experience at helping companies over difficulties or maximize the value of opportunities, And for companies in the growth stage, if you're trying to raise investment, boards can be incredibly helpful there with both connections and process. Also giving new investors confidence in the company if they see a senior board. So I think all of those are reasons beyond the basic legal requirement to assemble a high-quality board.
I guess once we decide that we need to assemble this high-quality board, and before getting to the point where I ask how do we figure out who those people are, I want to address a bit of the baseline of what the board does and what is the job of the board. So I'll start with just the baseline legal duties. These are set forth in Delaware law. Most of the companies that we deal with are Delaware C corporations, but every state has their own state law. Basically, appoint and supervise the officers of the company, primarily the CEO of the company, make major decisions for the company. So if you're going to sell equity, if you're going to sell the company, if you're going to do things that cost a lot of money and are material to the direction of the company, that gets elevated to the decision of the board. But they do other things. That's the basic of why they show up and do the meetings, and they add their value in other ways. So I'd like to ask Sam to comment on kind of what those other things are that he's seen to, his role and how valuable the board, in doing their duties can be.
Sure. I mean, whether it's a first-time CEO who may not have had experiences of a certain sort, or whether it's a CEO who's been who's been through a few things, but hasn't had the benefit of every experience in the world, I think board members can be exceptional mentors. The very first time I raised money, I would not have been able to do it. Perhaps at all, but certainly not with the speed and the effectiveness had I not had a good board mentor. And then many years later, we were for the first time going international. So we had a company and very rapidly needed to expand to Europe, and the plan was to open offices in 5 countries in reasonably rapid succession. And that went extremely well, not because we knew what we were doing from prior experience, but because we had a board member who we brought on specifically with expertise in taking American companies and helping them extend their operations and sales to Europe. And at the board level, that input was important because it did affect our strategy, it affected the way we raised capital, and it affected the way we thought about the structure of the organization. Even if we'd had that expertise at the operating level, I think it would not have had near the benefit to the organization as bringing that in at the board level and having it be there as a resource for me and also for the rest of the board to think about the large strategic aspects of that growth. So I think that the mentoring and the expertise are a critical function, are a critical benefit of a board, and frankly, the duties that I expect a board member to undertake.
And that's really part of our topic today. To me, boards of directors are concerned with governance and strategic matters for the corporation, the overall oversight of the corporation and its executives. But most board members tend to come out of executive ranks, often are serving as executives of other companies, and sometimes can't differentiate between the roles. So the point, or one of the points in managing your board, is to make sure they serve the function of a board and that they don't try to replace or usurp the duties of management. You don't want the board necessarily in the weeds unless you invite them there.
That's right. So critical and important for doing due diligence on board members. And for their onboarding, if they're a new board member, if they have not had significant board experience, for them to understand that they don't have their hands on the steering wheel because they're not in the company day to day, they don't have the operating context to make those tactical decisions, and so it's dangerous if they involve themselves. So it is an adjustment for first-time board members if they come out of the executive ranks to make sure that they keep themselves at that strategic level.
Right. And I would say, you know, and Stan, you've seen this firsthand, it's the CEO's role, or one of his roles, to manage the board. But it's also, it's the CEO's role to manage the strategy of the company. And when the board thinks that it's their role, that's when you start to have a problem between the executive ranks.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, you need and you want to have the board buy into the overall strategy of the company. You want the board's input as you're making decisions about the strategy. But I guess the question I've asked both of you is, you know, have you seen a situation where it makes a difference if the CEO is acting as chairman of the board or where the CEO is not and you've got a separate board member who's acting as chairman? Is it easier for the CEO to actually control the flow in one situation versus the other?
I'm old enough that I started in there. It was very common to have chairman and CEO be the same person, and it's less popular today, frankly, in some circles, best practice not to have that happen. And I suppose, you know, a factor in that is where, what stage does the company find itself. When I found the company, and I may be the only person to start with, so de facto I'm chairman and CEO, but I think, Joe, To your question, if a CEO is a first-time CEO and doesn't have experience scaling a company, at the same time doesn't have experience managing a board, those are two significant and different challenges, both critical to the success of the company. I have seen circumstances work very well where that CEO had a trusted advisor, someone with whom he or she knew they had a strong working relationship who did have experience managing boards, and that person was very effective as a chairman and took the load in effect off or shared that load with the CEO. And that has been, I think, an asset in those situations to a company.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we can't forget is that we really are talking about interpersonal relationships with board members. And when we talk about managing expectations, managing your board, you really are talking about having good interpersonal relationships, relationships of trust. And those tend to vary over time and across individuals depending on the situation. But, you know, you've got to have at least, to me, a foundation of mutual respect.
Absolutely. And I'm so happy that Leah decided to address the topic because, as I can tell you, as an entrepreneur and as an active member in the entrepreneurial community of mentoring entrepreneurs and sitting on entrepreneurial boards, it is not addressed enough, saying you have to attend to your board, and more importantly, this is a skill set that's not necessarily about logic or procedure. It's certainly not about domain expertise. It's about creating effective human relationships from senior people who think, I think, well of themselves, who may have a need, by the way, to project themselves into the world, and you've got to make them a functional operating unit. And if you don't think you have that skill set, it's good to get mentoring there, too.
No, I absolutely agree. And to go back a little bit to Joe's question of the differential between the CEO chairman and the separate CEO and chairman, for the younger companies, I would say it's almost always advisable to separate those two roles. And when I say almost always, if you don't have someone that's willing to sit in the chairman role and spend the time and has expertise, don't separate them until you have the right person that will spend time and dedicate themselves to the company. But it gives kind of a litmus test to the CEO, somebody who's looking at a higher view at the company that's not in the weeds every single day and can advise the CEO from that higher viewpoint. But, you know, I would say necessarily that person needs to be someone who's willing to dedicate more time to spend one-on-one time with the CEO, preparing for board meetings, advising, mentoring outside of the boardroom, and also to spend time, you know, talking to the other board members and creating that interpersonal relationship of trust among the group.
And I think it needs to be noted that in those kind of companies, particularly early stage development companies, the founder of the company, if serving as CEO, is typically the largest shareholder, if not the sole shareholder. So when we're talking about having board members, there is sort of a yin and yang to that relationship, given the fact that the shareholders are entitled to vote for and appoint the boards of directors. And in some respect, the boards of directors really are working at the pleasure of the shareholders because they can vote them out if the board isn't functioning the way it ought to be. More than that, and we'll talk a little bit about the rules of the road, the boards have fiduciary duties, and those fiduciary duties run to the companies and the shareholders for the benefit of the shareholders. And what that means, essentially, taking the legalese out, is that the board members have to be well prepared for what they're doing. They have to understand what they're doing. They have to prepare themselves to make decisions on things. They can rely on outside advisors, you know, financial advisors, lawyers, other types of advisors. That's fine, but they've got to get themselves prepared, and they've got to make sure that they understand what they're doing. Plus, they've got a duty of loyalty. They can't have self-interest that they're trying to put ahead of the interests of the corporation and its shareholders. So it's important that the board members understand that, but there's also some check on their running amok, given the fact that the shareholders do have ultimate control over who's on that board.
Yeah, I agree. And I think an interesting thing, especially with early stage companies, is managing that duty of loyalty. Because oftentimes, every single person in the boardroom has an interest in the transaction that's happening. And this goes back to the interpersonal skills and the communication and putting it on the table, what that interest is. Will the VC who's come in have a better financial gain out of this transaction if it happens? Will the large shareholder have a better financial gain? All of that information should be put out before any vote is taken so that everybody knows what the different inputs are.
And certainly from a potential liability standpoint, which is what I'm often looking at, clearly having all the information out there, having all the information thoroughly considered by the board before it makes a decision, and boards are protected by the business judgment rule, which essentially means that so long as they're acting reasonably on an informed basis within their business judgment, they've got some legal protection for their decision-making. You know, that's okay. But oftentimes it doesn't quite happen that way, particularly when things are happening very quickly.
Sure. So I want to step back a little bit and talk about the timing of putting that board in and the company's, you know, growth from a startup company to raising capital, et cetera. So what is, I guess you've gone through four different companies, Sam, so what do you think the best time is to get that kind of domain expertise outside board members built into your company?
I can speak from, you know, from direct experience, especially on boards on which I sat, when on my own. Earlier is better in the sense that you give yourself a longer runway, you can have more time to evaluate board members and put together a much more functional board. To have to hurry up, especially right before, it's not unusual for companies to suddenly realize they might need a board to give investors confidence, and they in effect hurry up, and it may in fact help them be successful at raising an investment round, but what they may end up with thereafter is some board members that it's tough to exit who are not particularly functional in the boardroom that drag the company back or slow its progress. And so I always favor doing it earlier, trying to get the appropriate expertise, and spending time on getting to know people before you formally make them a part of the board.
And so when you say do this earlier, do you do this before you raise your first dollars of outside investment?
I have. For me, the need to raise investment is it's an externality with respect to that's going to come along later with respect to the board. But the fact of the matter is, if we accept that a fundamental value of that board is to help the company strategically, I'd like their thoughts on that strategy before we begin to formulate the rationale for the investment. And they can be very helpful also in framing that raise. So I've always started early, tried to foresee what we need. And frankly, if you're recruiting experienced people, they may need some runway.
I will frequently I will have people say, right now my the dance card's full, but in 6 months my term expires, and I'd love to be on your board, and I can do it then. I can commit that time then. So even just beginning to cultivate potential board members early, in my experience, always pays off.
For startup companies, what's your experience been in terms of how you recruit, how you find the board members? Because, bigger Fortune 500 companies are often out there hiring headhunters, looking for, the key board members that they want to fill and slot into the post. My suspicion is that startups are not going to be able to afford that. So where do you find the contacts that lead you to the right people?
I have never used a search firm to find board members. I have just started with my personal network, and I'm not a networker. I am not one of those people who spends time thinking about and cultivating a network, but I have just asked people I know. I'm looking for the following type of person with the following background, experience, subject matter, expertise, and have managed to find high quality people that way. Frankly, Joe, in my experience, it's pretty astonishing. Early stage companies don't ask enough. They're afraid to ask senior people potentially. They probably know senior people, and they assume that they're going to get a refusal. And on the flip side, when I've recruited senior people, they often say, this is great. I love the excitement of a growth company, and nobody ever asks.
Have you found a situation where the senior people that you bring on board have friends that they'd like to bring on board? Because I've been involved with companies who have had, five graduates of the same class at the same university sitting on the same board. And, I don't think when the CEO started the board search, he intended for it to wind up that way.
I think that's right. And I suppose on one hand, you might be able to get some good expertise that you didn't have a personal connection to, but on the other hand, you have a runaway board there. So that's an interesting situation that you'd want to pay attention to.
Yeah, it does seem to kind of suit a building block at certain points in time, which or maybe a block to certain things that the company wants to do. So, and I guess what, for this purpose, we really can't emphasize how important it is to be selective about the people that you ultimately ask to be on the board.
I think in particular, entrepreneurs, even CEOs, feel uncomfortable or it does not occur to them that they should be doing due diligence on board members. And by due diligence, I don't mean just understanding what their background is and reviewing their resume. I mean talking to members of other boards on which they have previously sat and understanding whether they were functional, collaborative, contributing board members. Because, A, you can get a board member who doesn't contribute, never manages to show up, or doesn't do the pre-read, so his or her comments are irrelevant or time-wasting, or you get board members who need to be the dominating presence in the room. All of these things you can generally tease out with due diligence and avoid that. If you are willing to do that, and that's in my mind so important. It's a practice that has served me well, and I didn't learn it again. I think I don't know if this is talked about in big companies, but certainly it's not talked about in entrepreneurial circles. And I just happened on it because I'm a scientist by training. Yes. I like my data.
And someone I turned to a really good tool that Sam shared with us, and that's kind of a tool for planning out your board before you establish your board or as you need to add different members of your board. And so as an entrepreneur, startup company, and you say, I want to have a three-person board or a five-person board, maybe you don't pick the number of people first, but you're going to know that you need a domain expert in a specific area. Depending on how close you are to revenue, you might need somebody who's really expert in sales. And you need people that have expertise that you as the CEO do not have in particular, so that they can help mentor you and guide the company and add benefits. So before putting any names of cool people that you want down, or their friends or classmates, creating a chart like this will really help guide how the board gets developed and prevent things like the five classmates from the same university from being put on the board. So that might have been a very functional board. I don't know.
I'll refrain from comment. That's right.
Well, it's interesting as I look at the chart because, you know, one category is industry. And I assume what by that, Sam, you mean expertise generally in the same industry that your business is in. So have you found it helpful and healthy to have folks from different industries sit on the board?
Absolutely. I mean, look, there's no doubt about it. And I'm a student of best practices. I always assume that, you know, for any given function, there are some firms out in the world that are doing it exceptionally well. And if they're not my direct competitors, they're generally willing to share. And if those functions are particularly important to the company, you might want a board member with that expertise from a different industry. The reason I highlight, at least on this depth chart, is subject matter or domain expertise in this industry. You know, industries have very different structures. So a business plan that would work well in the pharmaceutical industry might not work well in the SaaS software industry and vice versa. And so I think given especially that entrepreneurial and growth companies are trying to operate right at the boundary of the art of the commercially possible, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. what they're trying to do. Someone who comes in with enough context to know what is commercially possible in that industry with the structure of the industry and either with an understanding of the operations of the industry or maybe some of the fundamental economics of the core technology of that industry is really valuable, and that's why that topic is there. But look, best practices on most things run cross-industry, and it's very valuable to have board members who have best practices on key functions on the board.
In my experience, I've also found that academics sitting on boards sometimes can be very functional, particularly deans of schools or presidents of universities, if you're lucky enough to snag them, because they've got expertise. And, you know, larger universities are just like big corporations, and they take the same types of skills to run, same types of executive decision-making and leadership.
Yes. For me, the reason the right-hand column is on that depth chart, have they had board experience before? Often applies to special categories like academics, mm-hmm. because if they've shown the ability to span the academic and business discipline, at least in a conversation, then that's really valuable. And the way to figure that out in many cases is by asking whether they've done that effectively on a board before. Because I've had experience, not on a board, thankfully, but, you know, we had this on a separate group of advisors, a couple academics, one of whom was very practical on the art of the commercially possible, and the other one from whom I learned a great deal of theory and got no particular business benefit. And so before you put somebody on your board of directors, you really have to tease that out. And I love that right-hand column just as a guide for me or the governance committee of the board to say, are we taking a risk? If this person had no board experience, how much of a risk are we taking that they won't be functional and we can't do due diligence in effect?
Well, and before we get to what you do if you have somebody on the board who isn't functional, you know, do you have a sense of what the optimal size of the board is, at least for your startups?
Right. I'm a sample set of one, right? But I will tell you that I've had extremely functional boards at the 5 to 7 range. They can be, and when I say functional, they are effective and agile. I've also had a very effective board that got up to 12, and it was very, and it also was very effective. Everybody was engaged. Everybody informed themselves. That's all on the for-profit side. Right? Nonprofits, I've had experience with larger boards. The function of many of the members was predominantly for fundraising as opposed to governance or mentorship. But I think for me, as growth stage, to keep it quote unquote manageable for me, the sort of 7-ish would be 5 to 7 would be ideal, and I've seen it be effective directly personally at 12.
In a non-public company, Leah, would you advise to create committees of the board?
So, yes, is the basic answer. You're going to have different expertise among your independent board members, and you're going to have different availability of time. So, you know, if you don't have a strong internal financial function, but you have somebody on your board that has a strong financial function, that is a recipe for creating a financial and audit committee, and so that you have somebody who can meet more often and help oversee the financials and the development and planning of that. A lot of times you might have a one-off committee that you won't necessarily see in a public company, like a product committee. So your company has one product that's going to go to market first. You have a domain expertise in that marketplace, and they're going to meet once a month to talk about the product planning. Having smaller subcommittees involving other executives in those committees is very typical within early-stage companies. An important thing of creating those committees is the board should set out what those committees' job is, and so the committee's going into it knowing what kind of decisions they should be making, what should go to the board to make a decision, and often there is not that foresight.
And Joe, toward committees, I mean, there's an interesting, I had an aha moment. It wasn't until my second company. I ran across a board they had a number of committees, and many of the committee members were not board members, right? They weren't executives of the company either. And this structure has been effective for me on two fronts. There are often people, like perhaps an academic, who might not be functional on the board, but would be extremely functional on a technology committee to worry about, you know, continued development of the core technology of the company. And people are flattered to be invited to be on a board committee and don't have to. If your board authorizes the fact that committees don't have to have don't all have to be board members or executives, then you can almost get a mix of advisory board plus that feeds directly into the board. The reason that's also been valuable, it's been a great way for us to vet potential future board members. If we ask them to participate on a committee, they're not part of the board; they're just on a board committee. We can see how they function, and we don't necessarily tell them that we're doing this as to vet them for potential future boards so that it never gets uncomfortable. You say, thanks for serving on that committee, but if in fact they do well on that committee, you say, hey, would you consider a role on the board?
This is a way for somebody effectively to ease into board service.
Right.
Because
right.
If you're always looking to see whether someone's had board expertise or not, and that is a qualifying or disqualifying factor, it could be hard because you may not be able to refresh as easily as you want or bring, you know, some variety of talent in otherwise.
That's right.
Interesting.
I guess, you know, on that topic of refreshing, so while I introduced this as a way to plan your board in advance, it's a way to plan your board over time and keep your board up to date. How often do you refresh the board? And kind of what would be your advice on that topic?
Yeah, I find defined board terms to be a key tool for my ability to manage the board and exit people who aren't contributing effectively while letting them save face. So if we have defined board terms, a couple years, 3 years, whatever is appropriate, sometimes the investors will have a thought about this, but 2 or 3 year terms are particularly effective. If your operating agreement says in special cases or makes allowance for renewing a board member, but doesn't make it seem like the de facto choice, then I have the opportunity at the end of each period to sit with a board member and either just thank them for their service if we don't want them, or to ask them to remain if we do. And I think that's critical because otherwise it can be difficult to exit a board member. If you don't have a term limit, the board has to take specific action. That's a loss of face to that board member. Other board members may be sensitive to that. They may not want to do that. You can end up with a hanger-on. So I think advanced planning there and setting up the right governance structures so that there's a natural cycling that you can circumvent for the people you really want to retain helps save face and provide the CEO the opportunity to refresh that board.
Could we talk a little bit about keeping the boards on track and not having them running off the rails?
Oh, Oh, absolutely.
I always think the beginning place here is the board meeting. But as I say that, what I really mean, that's the end of the process. The beginning is the planning for the board meeting. And I guess what I've seen always for successful board meetings is a lot of planning, a lot of scrambling by executives leading up to the board meeting and making sure that where necessary, board members are informed about what's happening at the company ahead of time so that there are no bad surprises at the board meeting. I think what is, you know, a sensible approach, and Sam, I'd like you to comment, but is not to have board members surprised with bad news at the board meeting, because they are going to take it out on the CEO, and they're going to take it out as a group on the CEO, and that probably doesn't lead to the most functional board meeting.
And well, that's absolutely right. And frankly, if you're surprising board members in the meeting, you're not going to get the best of their mentoring. They don't have time to contemplate. Joe, that's so important to me that I have a ritual I go through. And in fact, I have the board meeting before the board meeting. I don't really mean that, but I will set up an individual call with each board member at least a week prior to the board meeting to review the agenda items, to start their thinking, and frankly, to sense whether I have a topic that I didn't realize was sensitive on the agenda, but that might be more sensitive than we're prepared to present on at the time. And so, you know, in doing that, I guess I'm doing exactly what you described, which is trying to avoid surprises, right? Whether surprises that I would inadvertently bring or that I might suddenly realize are the result of a sensitive topic. And I think that makes for extremely functional board meetings when you've done that sort of prep.
Your point about the agenda is a good one. I think having a fulsome but appropriate agenda is the right thing to do, and you've got to follow that agenda because it really is your guidelines, and it keeps the board members from going off into the weeds, as we've been talking about. You know, the joke is always whether the board members are going to be talking about what do you fill the vending machines with. And, you know, you want to keep them out of those kinds of conversations at the board meeting. And the way to do that is to have an active agenda and to have the chairman really move things along and move through that agenda.
Yes. And I, for many years, I did not understand the last item on most agendas, which was new business. Because as far as I was concerned, most of the stuff on the agenda was relatively new. I mean, certainly you have management reports, but a lot of the stuff that the board is going to consider was in my mind, quote unquote, new business. But then I sat on a board where I watched a masterful chairman, and any time a board member wanted to go off the rails, he would say, that's a really important topic, but that belongs under new business, which is the last item on the agenda. And the chairman made sure we got through everything. And frankly, if that was a controversial item, I'm pretty sure the chairman made sure that we ran out of time. But in all candor, a great tool for an entrepreneur, especially an early chair, is the last item on the agenda, which is new business, right? Things that were not put on the agenda prior to the meeting. And you can accept a contribution from any board member that's not in the sequence of the agenda and say, thank you, I definitely want to address that. I'm going to put that on the whiteboard, and as soon as we get the new business, that's what we're going to address. And it's a useful way to try and help keep the board in line.
So I want to bring up a dynamic that happens in the boardroom, and just Joe had introduced this, where it's a lot of work to have a board meeting. Sam had said that he has pre-meetings before every meeting, and I think one of the frustrations on the executive side is how much work it is to have a board meeting. And then on the board member side is, if you give me the documents the night before or even a day or two before, I don't have enough time to prepare for the board meeting. And then overlaying with that, how often do I need to have a board meeting? And really, it feels like as an executive, all I'm ever doing is preparing for the board meeting. So just introducing that topic, perfect. You know, ask Sam if you have any comments or suggestions to how to get out of that kind of roller coaster so you actually have a very productive board meeting.
Sure. And I would tell you that it's 20% of my time as a CEO is related to board management, preparing for board meetings. That's not an even 20%. Right? In cases where we're not taking on new strategic initiatives and and there aren't any surprises in the market, it's 10% of my time, and at other times it's 30 or 35% of my time, and it's unfortunate that it doesn't even out. But you have to account for that going in. And that is another reason why a CEO might want a separate board chair to share that, literally share the time load. Even if it's a comfort zone, the CEO may believe the company could more easily accelerate if he or she was spending time working on the company and had somebody to share that load of preparing for board meetings and teeing things up. So, but I mean, as a matter of course, you can't reduce the time below, in my mind, 20-ish percent, and get the productivity out of the board. And I mean, Leah, pre-reads, if they don't go out a week in advance, then people aren't going to read them. And then they don't come into the meeting with context, and you spend half the meeting bringing them up to speed on everything that was in the pre-read, and frankly, you're not getting the best of what they, of their judgment, of their expertise. So that's also critical, and it puts the onus on your executive team to close the books quickly and get the reports out and get them to board members. Early. I mean, get them to you so you can prepare the board book and get it to board members.
Well, and what I think in part you're saying is what I believe to be true, and that is you have to get a system in place. You have to get your board meetings on calendar so you know when they're going to be, and then you have to back off from those dates, and you have to have dates by which all the deliverables come in so you can get that meeting to go off without a hitch. And while it's still a lot of planning and a lot of work, at least when you know what you're doing and you make it more of a routine for the groups that are doing it, it's easier to deal with.
And I would agree with you. And I think an important part also of that calendaring all the events is getting your board members' buy-in. If you can only get material to them 4 days in advance on an average, they need to know they're going to get materials 4 days in advance so they can reserve time on their schedule to read the material. If you tell your board members you're not going to walk through every single slide in the materials at the meeting, they will likely read the slides before the meeting. But I've seen, executive after executive presenting exactly the slide deck that was sent out, which
right.
Why, as a board member, would I ever read beforehand if they're just going to read it to me when I get to the meeting?
That's right.
Well, and most of the time, then the board members are getting antsy because they can read the slide deck
exactly.
Even at the meeting faster than it's being presented, and then they're wondering why they're sitting there listening to what they just read.
And at that point, they seem like a very expensive board because
yeah.
They're not adding value.
That's right. And it's a little counterintuitive, perhaps, but In the first several years of the company, I'm frequently doing 6 board meetings a year and then back off to 4. Decisions are made sometimes faster in the early stages, but also it can keep the board meeting and the prep shorter for more frequent meetings. And for whatever reason, I find that board members are retaining the context well, especially new board members, when we're having 6 meetings every 2 months as opposed to every 4. And then as the company matures a little bit, if we can begin to see the product, if we can begin to assess things in terms of regular cycles, this quarter versus the same quarter last year, then we can back off to sort of 4 meetings a year. And that's been a productive cycle for me.
Well, and we talked earlier about committees, and one of the things we didn't talk about is an executive committee where the board delegates at least a limited amount of authority to a number of folks, usually including the chairman, to make decisions for the board if necessary in between board meetings.
Yes.
Have you had experience with that and has it been functional?
Joe, in my non-profit experience, exceedingly functional, mm-hmm. frequently used. In my for-profit, I can only think of one case in which the executive committee had to do anything material. It was almost like a break glass in case of emergency, sort of things. But it was very helpful there.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I've seen it in context, I'm sure Leah has too, where things are happening. Maybe the company is thinking about going public. Maybe the company is thinking about a sale process for a piece or a part of the whole company. They're having a group that's easily reachable without having to assemble the entire board.
Sure.
Makes life a lot easier on the executives, not to mention the lawyers.
And to Joe's point, this is a committee that's formed for a specific purpose oftentimes. So I'll call it a pricing committee, a special committee. It depends on what the topic is. And the board members who are signing up to be part of this committee, they understand the time commitment, how quickly they're going to have to get on calls, especially in an M&A process or a fundraising process. If the board really wants to have a voice in that process, they know that they might get, you know, a meeting invite in the morning for a new bit of detail that they have to talk about in the afternoon. A question to Sam is, this 6 times a year versus 4 times a year, do you have these in person? Do you have them by phone, by video? How do you get the best engagement out of your board members?
My ask up front is in person for all the meetings. When we're at a cadence of 4 per year. At 6 per year, if I've got board members who are not local, I ask their attendance of 4 per year. I prefer to do board dinner the night before a board meeting in the morning to give the board members some time to sync up. It also gives my executive team time to mingle with the board, and I find that incredibly useful because, if you're trying to do the social niceties or remember who's who on the executive team right during the board meeting, it can make the board meetings a lot less productive. And so I am generally asking people to come in for an evening, a night, and a morning,
mm-hmm.
4 times a year, typically we ask.
And I really like the board dinner the night before as well. When I was in-house, one of the chairmen that I worked with made us put a question out for the board dinner. The one question that the company strategically needed answered at that coming board meeting so that they could talk for hours if they wanted to with the scientists and with the different expertise from the company management and just have that conversation before we got to the board of the next day. And that I found very productive.
Yes, I think that would be really productive as long as there are people other than the board at the board dinner.
Yeah, so we are right.
I wouldn't want them to have a board meeting without the board meeting, but right, as long as you said scientists, if they've got other members of the executive team and members of the company who had but I can see why that would really help provide context.
Yeah, so we would strategize with the board chair in advance.
Really thoughtful construct. It's a smart idea because most board dinners are only the board members, so let them catch up with each other, and it's more of a social than a business affair. But I can see how that would be very functional.
Sorry, I'm going to take that one.
Thank you. So 4 times a year in person, in between meetings, usually teleconferences, video conferences. Do you have a preference?
I will tell you that the advances in video presence or remote presence have come so quickly of late that we've had to do, for a couple companies, we've had to do some ad hoc meetings where we couldn't get in-person attendance, and I was astonished at the productivity with some of these, the latest versions of tools, where you can make sure people are synced up, where frankly you can tell if they're paying attention.
That's the point of the video.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so I may be changing my opinion on this, but my general cadence has been to assume that we're going to do, that I'm going to update people in a unidirectional format. I'm going to send a monthly update to board members CEO, and we're going to accomplish the meat of everything at board meetings. And again, if you've got an acquisition or you're doing you've got a lawsuit or other things, yeah, you'd institute conference calls. But I really think that the video presence makes things so much more clear.
Let me shift and ask a little bit different question. Let's assume you're in a company where you're getting some venture money and someone is giving you a board member,
yes,
and it isn't necessarily someone you would have chosen yourself, or perhaps you didn't have much of a say in it. How do you deal with that board member?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is absolutely
It's a pretty broad question, I know, but
If it is certainly a consideration as you're raising money. If you have the opportunity to consider multiple potential investors, you need to understand if that's their expectation, and you should be interviewing the person they're going to designate as their rep and do due diligence on them as you would with anybody else, because it may make their money very expensive, in effect. So I'd be wanting to evaluate that member. I do understand the desire for a large investor to want to, in effect, babysit the company or have a window into what the company is doing with their money. I've been able to use the depth chart at times to say, we should have a representative, but I'd like them to add value here. Is there someone in your sphere who you would trust to be your representative, but who could also fill out one or more of these columns? I've actually had some success rather than getting them to just do the knee-jerk reaction to who they were going to put on, to be thoughtful about it and to put somebody on who I thought added value. But if it's a tough market, if you don't have your choice as much as you want of investors and they put somebody on, I acknowledge, and I've been on boards where that's been the case for companies, and for me, that means it's particularly important to have other board members who are influential, who can help keep that board member on task.
I think that's a good point, because if everything is moving along according to plan, and how often does that really happen, it's easy to keep that person on track and without having any kind of separate agenda or what feels like a separate agenda to a CEO. But I've often been brought into situations where things are not going quite the way they were planned, and the VC board member is acting more like an enemy than somebody who's supporting the company. That is a difficult situation for the CEO. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, and that's really managing the relationships. I think it's very tough on the CEO at that point, because you can't really marginalize that person, because they'll push back even harder.
That's right.
And I don't know what you've seen in that situation, but I once had a client from Japan give me a little advice on this. And they have an expression, apparently, little did I know, which was, when you meet the samurai, embrace the samurai. Which effectively is a Japanese expression, as I understand it, is keep your friends closer, your enemies closer.
Look, the other piece is, I have a great affection for venture capitalists, and I don't say that facetiously, but I've never expected them to be anything other than they are. They will tell you, and the reason I have affection for them is they will tell you what their objectives are, and they stick to those objectives. If they're successful venture capitalists, they know how to do what they do. And the entrepreneurs that I meet who really end up with having difficulty are the ones who hear that and say, oh, that's great, but I'll take their money, but my aims are different, and somehow I'll manage to affect my aims as opposed to their aims. And that's where I think you end up with very difficult situations. If you understand, it is worth saying to a venture capitalist, I want to draw a little picture on the whiteboard. Okay, you're investing here. Things are going very well. What do you expect? What are you going to do? Okay, here's your investment. Things are not going as well. How do you react? It is a very fair question. They'll respect you for asking it, and you'll know in advance that they're going to say to you, well, right, we're not going to follow on unless we can, we might require a down round because we need to protect our investment. We'd like to support the company, but, we will have demonstrated that the value that the prospective value wasn't as high as we thought. This is what we would do in that situation, what we have done. And at least you know it. You're therefore not shocked when they behave that way. But the other thing, I guess, Joe, if, you know, I don't know if there's another Japanese proverb, but I would say, right, one samurai at the table and the rest of us without armor or swords is one thing, but three samurai around the table who aren't of the same business school class might be a better structure for an entrepreneur to help one from really pushing a particular agenda.
So we're coming up on our hour, so I want to ask both Joe and Sam if, you know, they have any nuggets of, you know, takeaways or stories that they'd like to leave us with as we finish up this hour program.
I think all I would say just in summary is choose your board members wisely. If they're not functional, find a way to lose the board members quickly and painlessly for everybody involved. Remember that this is a matter of respecting everybody and their relationships. You know, business lives are typically long, and you're going to come across the same people again and again, so you got to watch out for that. I've seen people who have had rough goes with board members treat them poorly, and, you know, a decade later, they wind up in a company where these folks are on the board again, and you just never know how that's going to happen, and I think you've got to be very, very careful. And remember, finally, that the aim that everybody ought to have is the success of the company. And so long as everybody is thinking about that, there's room for differences of opinion. And articulating that every once in a while is a healthy thing.
I think that's, Joe, that's exactly right. And reasonable people, I've relied on the premise that reasonable people in possession of the same information will come to the same approximate conclusion. And if you have done your work to recruit reasonable people to the board, it solves many, many ills to make sure the board is fully informed and give them time to deliberate with respect. I think, in general, there aren't too many conclusions that boards I've been on have arrived at, if they were well informed, that were counter to the interests of the company.
Okay, great. And just a quick takeaway from what Joe was just saying, and I had never thought of this, but mapping yourself as the CEO into your board depth chart, it's very valuable, you know, understanding who you are and how you're going to interact with the other people you're mapping onto that depth chart and mapping into your boardroom.
Self-awareness is a difficult thing to achieve. Right.
But it'll greatly help with your ability to manage the relationships in the boardroom. And the other thing from my side, and this is me as a transactional attorney, planning, planning, planning. Like, I like to set up actually an agenda of board work over a 12-month period, so that at least I know the baseline to my agenda, what it's going to be in 6 months from now. And then we can talk about the different strategic decisions, what the company needs to do, but you have the baseline of what the board work is expected to be across the year.
I mean, that's a great tool also for managing board members, because If they want to go off on a topic and say, oh, guys, remember the year calendar. That's the topic of a third quarter board meeting.
Yeah.
Right? So I absolutely want to prep on that for two meetings from now.
Yeah.
And it can be really helpful.
You know, I want to thank both of you for your time and, you know, your expertise in this area. A quick commercial. We have a California Consumer Privacy Act webinar coming up in a couple of weeks. We have a Venture Love meetup for December, coming up on December 6th. The topic is actually known, which is the top 10 things that you didn't know when you were starting your company and should have. And then a little bit of self-promotion. I will be talking at a local event, the next stories that scale the next 15 years of entrepreneurship, on November 20th. So thank you, everyone, for your time, for your expertise.
Thank you.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.